John Adams, second president, to his son John Quincy upon the latter's accession to the White House.
No man who ever held the office of the presidency would congratulate a friend upon obtaining it.
President Woodrow Wilson.
Things get very lonely in Washington sometimes. The real voice of the great people of America often sounds faint and distant.
Franklin Roosevelt in the wartime spring of 45.
The detail of this work is killing me.
Admiral George Dewey, who could afford to feel somewhat differently. He never became president.
If the American people want me for this office, I'll be only too willing to serve them. Since studying the subject, I am convinced that the office of the president is not such a difficult one to fill.
Living 1949. Presented each week at this time by NBC and its affiliated stations, with a respectful glance over its shoulder at a man standing on a platform last week in Washington, D.C., holds up its radio mirror to reflect the image of an office in a drama document entitled
The Biggest Job in the World.
Now, once again, here is your narrator, Ben Grauer.
Greetings, America. Last week in Washington, the same hand which on Thursday was raised to take the oath of office, on Monday gripped pen to sign a special message asking Congress for power to reorganize that office. In the scales of history, the reorganization message transmitted to the Congress on Monday may well outweigh in import and results the oath-taking which, with its attendant ceremony and hijinks, had all the nation by the ears and eyes on Thursday. Our concern today is mainly to ask why.
Why has the presidency, the man, and the executive, the office, been made the subject of a searching study by Herbert Hoover and a commission of picked administrative minds?
Why, using their conclusions for evidence and support, did President Truman feel impelled to ask for reorganization powers?
And what about the founding fathers? How did they conceive the presidency, its powers and limitations?
How, in a century and a half, has the office grown to its complex commanding stature of today?
What men made it so? And finally, has the presidency become a burden too overwhelming for any one man to handle?
These, America, are the questions we pose on Living 1949 and undertake to answer. For our beginning, we go to Philadelphia, to that neat little state house where in the summer of 1787, 162 years ago, were gathered Washington, Madison, Randolph from Virginia, Morris and Hamilton from New York, James Wilson from Pennsylvania, and 20 others. Great men, newly free and determined to remain so, they are fashioning the blueprint of a nation. On this hot summer day in 1787, they debate the place of the executive in their new constitution. General Washington in the chair will presently recognize Mr. Wilson of Pennsylvania. The points at issue seem to be whether to repose the executive power in one man or in a group which shall choose the executive, then the length of term of office, and most important of all, whether the executive shall have real power or be a mere echo of the Congress.
Mr. Wilson, I much prefer a single magistrate. The single executive is the breeder of monarchy.
Mr. Sherman of Connecticut,
the number should not be fixed. The executive ought to be appointed by and accountable to the legislature.
Gentlemen, one moment, gentlemen. If he ought to be the guardian of the people, let him be appointed by the people.
The people then, rather than the Congress, should elect the president, a single president, urged James Wilson of Pennsylvania. And that view eventually prevailed. As to tenure,
the term shall be 4 years, with no limit on re-election.
As to power,
the executive is nothing more than an instrument for carrying into effect the will of the legislature.
That is the weak view, as against,
we must either renounce the blessings of the Union, or provide an executive with sufficient vigor to pervade every part of it.
And what did they settle for? The Constitution, as adopted, told the president he could make treaties, but only
by and with the advice and consent of the Senate.
They told him that he could make appointments, but only...
by and with the advice and consent of the Senate.
They even gave him the power to veto acts of Congress, but with a very visible string attached. If 2/3 of the House in which the bill originated still wanted the law, they could pass it again, send it along to the other House, and...
if approved by 2/3 of that House, it shall become a law.
Many an American, pondering the future of his government in those days, and taking note of the fence built around the president by these and other limitations, was inclined to agree with the Pennsylvania legislature when it prophesied...
it is probable that the president of the United States, limited as he is in power and dependent on the will of the Senate, will have neither the firmness nor the inclination to exercise his prerogative.
How exceedingly vigorous that prerogative was to become, through its exercise over the years by 8 men with both firmness and inclination to spare, those founding fathers little dreamed.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will to the best of my ability.
32 men in all have taken that oath. Of those 32, 8, the historians tell us, have played a major role in making the American presidency the biggest job in the world. 8 of 32, a respectable average in any league. The role? George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Grover Cleveland, Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Question: what makes for a strong president?
Well, one explanation is summed up in the phrase...
crisis and personality.
A combination. The times and the man. Who knows what president, listed as a mediocrity from the long perspective of history, might have risen to the challenge had there been a challenge. Now, for reason number 2 for the evolution of presidential power, we call on historian James Bryce.
The larger a community becomes, the less does it seem to respect an assembly. The more is it attracted by an individual man.
The sheer growth of our nation, then, the mere impact of swelling numbers, serve to elevate the prestige of leadership, to make us look to the White House rather than to the Congress for the answer to questions that trouble us.
So much for the national backdrop. So much for the political climate in which the presidency has become the office it is today. Now, what about the men?
Number 1, and first in more ways than one, George Washington. His was the crisis of national birth, and he handled it superbly, with the dignity, the honor, the scrupulous sense of duty which made him the natural leader in a generation of great men.
George Washington set the pattern for the biggest job in the world.
Number 2, Thomas Jefferson. His contribution?
Assertion of party leadership. He saw in the political party an instrument and a weapon for the hand of the executive.
And so President Jefferson summons to the White House a group of party leaders.
And now, gentlemen, I suggest that the proposal for the purchase of the Louisiana Territory be made by you in Congress, rather than publicly by me. This will put upon the purchase a desirable character, as though it be the will of the people, and not a mere whim of the executive.
Thus, through his party in Congress, Jefferson devised a tool and set a precedent for moving the wheels of state. Number 3.
By thunder, here's the man for me.
Yes, sirree. A man that is a man.
Yep. Tough as nails. A fellow to scare setting hens off in their eggs.
Well, when he makes a speech, the roof rings like it's hit by a goddamn combobulated thunder gust.
They say his old lady can crack walnuts with her teeth.
Sure. Regular folks like us.
He's for the little fella.
And he's for us. And we're for him.
We aim to elect a president.
President of the unwashed and unterrified.
Yes, sir, by gee, we'll show them Bay State nabobs, them tidewater tycoons. We'll elect our man for a change.
And who is he?
Old Hickory.
Who?
General Andy Jackson.
Echoing through the Cumberland Gap and along the Wilderness Road, they were crying his name. The first man of the people. The first hero of the common man, Andrew Jackson. And he came to the White House, this stubborn leader, stubbornly convinced that he bore in the pocket of his faded campaign coat a mandate direct from the people, a mandate bidding him to brook no nonsense from anyone, least of all from Congress.
His contribution to the presidency was not so much a stiffening of the office as it was a remaking, a revolution.
12 times bills came down from Capitol Hill, and 12 times they went thundering back.
Veto! Can't do this to us. Why, there have only been 9 vetoes in all past administrations put together.
In his most famous veto message, these words of Jackson struck the national ear as pretty rugged stuff.
The opinion of the Supreme Court has no more authority over Congress than the opinion of Congress over the court. And on that point, the president is independent of both.
Of course, Congress shook its mane and thundered back. Cried Daniel Webster,
such a universal power of judging over the laws and over the decisions of the judiciary is nothing else but pure despotism.
And Henry Clay, backing Webster in this battle of the giants,
we are in the midst of a revolution rapidly tending toward the concentration of all power in the hands of one man. This power was...
Remember, friends, this is 1833, not 1933.
The powers of Congress are paralyzed, except when exerted in conformity with his will.
But while Clay and Webster screamed, Jackson merely listened and let the people answer for him. Time after time, the voters returned Jackson men to Congress. In his iron bid for presidential strength, the people were behind him. Number 4 among the men who made the presidency strong. The crisis, a nation divided, brother against brother, the war between the states. And the man...
Old Abe Lincoln came out of the wilderness, out of the wilderness, out of the wilderness. Old Abe Lincoln came out of the wilderness, out of Illinois.
Buchanan, frustrated and futile in the face of an issue which seemed bigger than the nation itself, had said,
you have no right to secede, but I can do nothing to stop you.
But Buchanan's successor, that long, lank, unknown quantity from Illinois, in his inaugural address sang a somewhat different tune.
No state upon its own mere motion can lawfully get out of the Union. I shall take care, as the Constitution enjoins me, that the laws of the Union be faithfully executed in all the states, unless my rightful masters, the American people, shall in some authoritative manner direct the contrary.
Note well, America, 2 essential points in Abraham Lincoln's conception of the presidential office. First,
his duty to preserve the Constitution,
surpassed only by
his duty to respect the sovereignty of the people.
Yes, like Jackson, Lincoln had instinct for the sense and substance of the people, and a feel for their essential strength. Not, however, in support of the naked theory of presidential power, but rather for the preservation of the common good, in short, the Union. Throughout the agony of those years, the war years, Lincoln never allowed the terrible press of official business to raise a partition, an iron curtain 1865, so to speak, between the president and the people.
Thank you, General, and now, if you'll excuse me...
But, Mr. President, I had hoped...
I'm sorry, General. There are others waiting, people I must see.
But when I came through your anteroom, Mr. President, there was no one.
No one?
Oh, well, the room was full, of course, but riffraff, sir, riffraff. I mean to say, such common people.
Exactly. Like me. And I'd better not forget it.
But
I see them every day, General, rain or shine.
Oh, Mr. President, you can't mean
that. Yes, General. I call these daily interviews with the common people, as you say, I call them my public opinion baths.
Your public opinion baths?
Because they're renovating and invigorating. They help me remember how much I rely more... how much the future of us all depends on the confidence and common sense of our fellow citizens.
Yes, Lincoln avowed and never forgot that the source and final repository of power and wisdom lay not with the president, nor the Congress, nor the court, for they were merely instruments, but with the people. And that's why, when the time came for him to assert most eloquently, most finally, the timeless, deathless indivisibility of the Union, he chose not the halls of Congress, but an open field where common men had died, where common men now had come to listen.
Here gave the last full measure of devotion, that we highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that the nation shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth.
Bearing in mind, America, the spiritual link between president and people established by Jackson and Lincoln, we can better understand some of the statements of the four strong presidents who came after.
Grover Cleveland, man of conscience.
Public office is a public trust.
Theodore Roosevelt, leader of opinion.
The White House is a bully pulpit.
Woodrow Wilson, political scholar.
The president must be the spokesman for the real sentiment and purpose of the country.
And in our time,
the presidency is preeminently a place of moral leadership. All our great presidents were leaders of thought at times when certain historic ideas in the life of the nation had to be clarified.
Again, we find pertinent the words of that classic commentator upon us, the Englishman James Bryce.
Nowhere is the rule of public opinion so strong as it is in America, or so direct. A president is strong because his rights come straight from the people.
And don't think our strongest presidents haven't known that. By slow accretion through the years, and as we've seen, with the consent of the people, the power of the president has steadily grown. Until today, the president embodies in himself such a multiplicity of functions, such a diversity of duties and demands upon him, that, in the words of Mrs. Warren G. Harding,
I don't want my husband in the White House. The office is killing President Wilson just as surely as if he had been stabbed at his desk.
Inventory. 7 items of the presidential load.
Chief of State.
Here, Washington was preeminent.
Chief of Administration.
Cleveland was outstanding here.
Chief of Legislation.
Score 1 here for Woodrow Wilson.
Chief of Public Opinion.
The fireside chat, remember?
Chief of Foreign Relations.
Tread softly and carry a big stick.
That was the other Roosevelt, T.R.
Chief of Party.
Jefferson set that pattern.
Commander-in-Chief.
Lincoln, Wilson, FDR. Seven items, and everyone certainly in itself a full-time job in its larger policy-making aspect alone. Now, add to that the endless detail.
Mr. President, these bills are ready for your signature.
Yes, every act of Congress, every commission in the armed forces, every proclamation, appointment, federal pardon, executive order must be signed by the indispensable hand. All the way from...
And the state of war between the United States and the imperial government of Japan, which has thus been thrust upon the United States, is hereby formed.
Down to this.
The Congress directs Treasury to pay the sum of $100 to Rastus L. Davis of Winona, Texas, in full settlement of all claims against the United States for the watermelons stolen by soldiers from Apache New York.
Yes, 600 times a day on an average, the president signs his name. With the same hand which, in reception line after reception line, grasps the hand of king and commoner, until, in the words of one writer, his palm grows gray with the grime of democracy. In fact, they tell a story about Theodore Roosevelt. It's toward the end of a long and weary public function at the White House. At last, the president, through tired eyes, sees the end of the reception line approaching. A little man, neutral with the hue of anonymity, steps eagerly forward. He's a Washington tailor. And he murmurs,
You don't remember me, Mr. President. I'm the man who made your shirts.
Oh, yes. It's nice to see you again, Major Shirts.
Yes, even Teddy Roosevelt, even that arch-apostle of the strenuous life, sometimes succumbed to the occupational disease, presidential fatigue. Add...
State dinner, 6 a season by protocol.
Add...
Openings, dedications, laying of cornerstones, welcoming delegations.
Add...
Press conferences.
Just one more question, Mr. President, if you don't mind. This one's off the record.
After one particularly trying bout with the press, one recent president is said to have observed,
"I feel as though I've just been examined by the entire staff of the Mayo brothers."
In short, the president combines in himself functions performed in England by king, prime minister, cabinet officers, and other officials.
And we, the people, insist that he do it.
To which sentiment, Grover Cleveland wearily responded,
"When a man assumes a public trust, he should consider himself public property."
And everybody's property must be nobody's property, a condition which brings with it great loneliness. Many a president has felt it. It was Cleveland again who put it into words.
"I'm sick at heart and perplexed in brain. I almost think the professions of my friends are but the means they employ to accomplish selfish ends. Henceforth, I must have no friends."
He was speaking, of course, of that ever-vexing problem of patronage, a burden which is said to have killed at least two of our presidents. The general atmosphere of damned if you do, damned if you don't, in which a president lives, prompted Don Marquis to observe,
"There is bound to be a certain amount of trouble running any country. If you are a tyrant, you can arrange things so that most of the trouble happens to other people. But if you are a president, the trouble happens to you."
The magnitude of the presidential load was dramatized a fortnight ago as ex-president Hoover and, a significant aside, the only living ex-president, emerged from a conference with President Truman to meet reporters in the steps of the White House.
"Could you tell us, Mr. Hoover, what you and the president talked about?"
"Yes.
We discussed giving the president authority to reorganize the government by executive order."
"Is that necessary?"
"Very. If some 70 agencies, commissions, bureaus now running around loose, to be brought into control of one of the departments."
"Well, where are they now?"
"They focus up directly to the White House. If the president gave each one of them only 1 hour, it would take up 70 of his hours each week."
A 70-hour week for but one of the president's many administrative tasks. Perhaps we have just about reached that point, predicted a generation ago by Woodrow Wilson.
"We shall be obliged to pick our chief magistrate from among wise and prudent athletes, a small class. For men of ordinary physique and discretion cannot be president and live if the strain be not somehow relieved."
Wanted, then, one athlete, wise and prudent, who is also
intellectual and man of action,
orator and thinker,
administrator and statesman,
leader and man of the people,
farmer, industrialist, financier,
simple as the grass roots at home,
yet shrewd as a horse trader in the Council Hall of Nations. All this and more, for as a certain First Lady once said,
"Yes, the president should be both a politician and an administrator, but far more than these qualities, he needs an understanding heart."
In the light of this amazing complex of duties which are the president's by mandate from ourselves, and the attributes of character we insist he have, we will, I'm sure, agree upon the aptness of our title,
"The Biggest Job in the World,"
and upon the wisdom of the inquiry upon which Herbert Hoover and his colleagues are presently engaged,
the Commission on the Reorganization of the Executive Branch of the Government.
Last week, President Truman told Congress that an act giving him permanent powers to reorganize government is, in his judgment,
"an essential step toward efficient and economical conduct of the public's business."
To which the leader of the Senate opposition, Robert Taft, responded,
"It should be carefully examined."
Whether the Reorganization Act, currently proposed, is one worthwhile step now rests with your Congress to decide. But surely this and every other move growing out of the report of the Hoover Commission, soon to be released, will merit, as Senator Taft suggests, the most careful examination. For, and it implies no disrespect, America, to say it and understand it and say it again, the President of the United States is your creature. You made the office. The importance of that office, not alone to America, but to the world, is today quite literally incapable of overstatement. That the man who occupies it be equipped and empowered and aided in every way possible to ease his burden and his inevitable cares is a matter of immediate concern to you and me and every child in China and every man alive. Workmen are now repairing the White House against the ravages of age. If it be necessary to shore up the sagging walls and floors of the presidential home, it may equally behoove us to renovate the accumulated architecture of the presidential job.
Living 1949 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air
by an NBC special program staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold. Today's script was written by Wade Arnold. Music is conducted by Milton Kadams. This program is directed by Jack Cuny. We invite you to keep abreast of Living 1949 by listening next week when we present as our very special guest, Mr. Fred Allen, in a drama document entitled
The State of American Humor.
Douglas Fairbanks, Jr. stars on The Exile tonight on NBC.